It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest has spent the last year tracking media reports of gun violence. We'll hear why and what he found out.
First, though, the enduring effects of the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan on the Americans who fought them may be worse and farther reaching than we first thought.
That's according to a new report out from the Washington Post and the Kaiser Family Foundation. Here's a quote. More than half of the 2.6 million Americans dispatched to fight the war struggle with physical or mental health problems stemming from their service, feel disconnected from civilian life, and believe the government is failing to meet their needs.
This report is part of a three-part series on the impact of the war on its veterans. The first two installments were released last week, and the final installment will be out later this month.
Joining us now is Rajiv Chandrasekaran, who wrote about the results. He's senior correspondent, associate editor, and former Baghdad bureau chief for The Washington Post. Rajiv, thanks for being with us.
Good afternoon. Good to be on.
How many veterans were involved in this study?
Well, we polled about 850 veterans. That gives us a statistically significant sample set. And that was a sample that was there are things we know about our 2.6 million veterans and those who have served out in these wars. You know, we know roughly the gender breakdown, the racial breakdown, where they're from. And so our pool very much mirrored the overall national population, so we feel it's a pretty representative sample.
And one of the most striking and disturbing results you found: one in two vets knows a veteran who has attempted suicide. Have mental health challenges become just part of the culture of military of veterans?
Well, these wars have extracted a tremendous mental and emotional toll on our forces. We found that 31% of veterans say that their mental or emotional health is worse today than before they deployed. About 4 in 10 say they experience outbursts of anger, and about a similar percentage say that they have relationship problems. They're two of the 20 indicators for post-traumatic stress. And, of course, the suicide figure that you cited. They've taken a real beating here in these wars. Now, I don't mean to suggest that all of our veterans are damaged beyond repair or are ticking time bombs. Far from it. We know that two-thirds of them don't have any lasting mental health consequences. And for those who have reported problems, many of them are seeking treatment, and many of them are getting better. There is a positive story here in the path to recovery. But what it does show is that there is an enormous burden being placed, a cost, on our Defense Department and on our Department of Veterans Affairs to care for these folks we've sent into harm's way, both physically and mentally, for many of them for some years to come.
And speaking of physically, you found a lot of physical health problems, not necessarily from being wounded or injured in combat, but just things related to being deployed in a dangerous area. What are some examples of the physical problems?
So, in some cases, it's the very stuff that was designed to save our troops. Body armor, which have ceramic plates in the front and the back to stop automatic weapons fire. Kevlar helmets to protect their heads. Well, all that stuff is all well and good, and it saved many, many lives, but it has come at a cost for some. After multiple tours with folks wearing the stuff day in, day out for a year, they're reporting back problems, hip problems, knee problems. We're finding people with abnormally high hormone levels that are just completely out of whack. Others are showing respiratory problems because of smoke and dust they've been breathing in there. So when we think of those who've been wounded by their time at war, typically people think, oh, they must have been shot. They must have been injured in an explosion.
Yeah.
But it's more than that.
The occupational hazards that a civilian maybe wouldn't even think of.
Certainly not.
And then those two things combined with other factors make it difficult for veterans to find employment, you found, as part of this series. What are the challenges there?
Well, what we found was a sort of a varied story for officers, for those who have college degrees, who've had real leadership skills in the military. They haven't had too much trouble, and they're pretty optimistic about taking their military service and plowing it in to a good job in the civilian world. But there's a lot more nervousness, a lot more frustration from troops who served in an enlisted capacity, those who don't have a college degree, they're very worried about transitioning into the private sector and worried whether their military service will help them or hurt them. They're worried about how they're going to move forward in an economy that's still struggling to add jobs.
Well, and you mentioned some of those physical injuries. People with bad backs are having trouble getting jobs in any occupation that requires lifting, manual labor. Just that occupational hazard from the military is making it harder to get jobs.
You know, that's a very good point. And indeed, that's something we found. Some of these physical and mental costs of the war make it much tougher to slot oneself into manufacturing jobs or other sorts of employment that might be physically demanding or might involve being around loud machinery or jobs in the retail space that involve having to be around lots of strangers on any given day, which might be hard for some people still going through issues of post-traumatic stress.
There's a nationwide effort, Chamber of Commerce and others, pledging to actively seek to hire veterans. How is that going?
Well, there are a lot of jobs that are pledged out there. The question is matching them up to veterans who have the right skills. And so there's a skills gap. There's also sort of a knowledge gap. Getting people in front of the right employers, there's a lot of positive talk from corporate America, but there's still some real questions with follow-through. And then even when veterans get hired, there's some big questions to be addressed about retention. What's being done to help ensure that the veteran who does get a job keeps that job, and some of the unique challenges that some of them may face in their readjustment get addressed by employers instead of simply brushed off.
And speaking of help with the transition or just getting help in general with the needs of veterans, what did you find when you asked veterans about the availability of mental health treatment, physical medical treatment as veterans?
Well, so there's still a lot of frustration there among the veteran population about the services that are being provided by the Defense Department and the Department of Veterans Affairs. Well, we found almost 60% saying that they believe that the government is doing a poor or only fair job of meeting the needs of this generation of veterans. That said, when we asked them, how are your own needs being met, 80-plus percent say their own needs were being met pretty well. So what accounts for that difference? Well, I think to some degree, people are doing okay, but when they sort of look out there, they're concerned for their comrades. And I think it also speaks to the role that non-governmental organizations are playing here, charities, faith-based organizations, other community groups. You got a lot of other actors stepping into this space wanting to help our veteran population. It's not just the government. And so when you take it all together, veterans say, you know, we're getting some pretty good services there.
We just listed a lot of negatives: emotional, mental health concerns, physical problems,
yep,
difficulty transitioning, getting jobs. You also asked veterans if you had it to do over again, would you do it? And do you regret this? What did you find? What did they tell you?
So the answer here, before I tell it to you, is something that I think most civilian listeners are going to find really surprising. And when I shared the answer before publication to friends who are in the military, they said, yeah, we pretty much guessed that. So knowing everything they know now about the risks, about the sacrifice, about the separation from family, about the privations of being at war, 89% say they'd do it all over again.
89% said they'd do it over again.
Yep.
So what did they say? How did they talk about the war? What were the positives that made them say that?
So among the reasons, you have almost the same percentage saying they feel proud about something they did at war. Sometimes they feel proud about a lot of what they did. In some cases, they feel proud about a few things they did, but there's a lot of pride there. They looked at the work they did positively. In fact, many of them say they miss being at war. It's not that they miss being away from home. It's not that they loved the nations of Iraq or Afghanistan, but they missed the camaraderie. They missed being there with their fellow soldiers, sailors, Marines or airmen. They missed simply kind of serving next to their buddies, people talk a lot about how, you know, when folks are at war, they're not fighting for broader national policy. They're fighting for the person to the left and the right of them in the foxhole.
So do we learn anything from all this, what we're learning from our veterans about how to prepare for future wars, how to deal with the needs of veterans today?
I think there are many takeaways, but one of the biggest is that when you go to war and you send an all-volunteer force, which means you're putting a burden on a small group of Americans, a pretty heavy burden. You're sending people for multiple tours. I mean, we found that, 20-plus percent were on more than two tours in Iraq. You're putting this huge burden on them. It's going to come with a real cost, and a cost of providing medical care and treatment, cost of providing services to help adjust them to the civilian world. And so what you see here is in real stark relief, the real decades-long cost of these two wars. According to the Veterans Administration, 37% of our veterans have been awarded some degree of service-related disability, which they will get lifetime payments connected to these two wars. It's an enormous cost. I'm not trying to suggest it's not due. I mean, these individuals have served heroically, and they deserve it. But when you think about going to war, you have to think about what is the cost of the after war.
Rajiv, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for devoting time to this issue.
We've been speaking with Rajiv Chandrasekaran. He's senior correspondent and associate editor and former Baghdad bureau chief for The Washington Post.
A little over a year ago, New York Times op-ed columnist Joe Nocera set out on a mission. He wanted to find as many media reports of gun violence in the United States as he could. Since February of last year, he's been compiling those reports and sharing them with the public.
He joins us now to tell us why he's doing it and what he's learned along the way. Joe Nocera, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why did you start this compilation of gun violence reports in the United States?
Well, somebody had to. Well, it happened sort of like pretty much by accident. I wrote a column in which I just listed examples of gun violence that had taken place that week, and it hit me. It was a very powerful column, I thought, and readers really reacted to it. And I thought that one thing that was missing in the gun debate was something that would give you a feel for the size and scope of the problem. So with the help of my assistant, who, to be frank, does most of the work at this point, all we just did was a simple Google News search and just compiled every gun incident that we came up with that we could find. And it was really as simple as that. So we've been doing it now for a year plus.
And what kind of stories count as a hit? What gets included?
Well, if it's in the newspaper or in some media, it gets included. I mean, we don't have the ability, suicides tend not to get included because most suicides don't make the newspaper. But anything from a drive-by gang shooting to a tragedy where a child is hurt or killed because there's a gun in the house, makes the cut. And there have been times when we've reported on somebody using a gun to protect themselves from an intruder. The gun rights people often accuse us of skewing it to make gun owners look bad, but we actually don't skew it. We just report what we find.
And how many stories do you come across in a given day or a given week?
I'd say in a given day, anywhere between 20 and 30.
20 and 30.
And on weekends, it's much, much, much worse. It's probably more like 50 a day, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And we do a weekend one that just takes forever to compile because it's so long.
And you're not intending this as science, but how do the numbers you find compare to other efforts to track gun violence?
I don't know because I don't know that anybody else is doing this. I mean, other people have tracked it purely with numbers, like Slate tried to do that for a while, and it's been picked up by somebody else. But I don't have any way of gauging our numbers versus anybody else's numbers. And in truth, I don't have the time or the effort to try and figure that out. What I wanted to show was what a representative sample of gun violence in America looked like on a day-to-day basis, and that's what we've done fairly successfully.
Well, I printed off just a small snippet of some from the Friday report. Just that was the most recent one when I printed. Here's a little bit. Torrance Gamble, 16, was shot in the head and killed in New Haven, Connecticut, Thursday night. The second teenager to be killed in a shooting in New Haven in the past 2 weeks. Police have not released suspect information or a motive. That's from the New Haven Register. Bobby Lee Cristofoli, 42, was shot and killed during an argument with an acquaintance outside a home in Lexington County. Sierra Simmons and Control Perkins were shot and killed in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And it goes on and on. And as you say, 20 to 30, maybe 50 a day. By printing this, what are you hoping a reader gets out of it and thinks and feels when they hear and read those stories?
Well, I think one takeaway is how preventable so much gun violence is. I think you read these, especially there's so much. I've learned a lot from this myself. One is, you know, how much gun violence is the result of momentary rage or anger that just, you know, you just happen to have a gun, so you grab the gun and you shoot the guy. Another is how many children die because there's a gun in the house. I was really surprised. I mean, it's probably not every day, but it's probably every other day we have at least one of those. But we're trying to show how the extent to which it really is an epidemic of violence. That it's if you live in a place, you only read about the violence that takes place in your community, and when you see this, you realize that this is happening all over the country every single day. It's not something that's just happening once in a while, and that it really is of epidemic proportions.
You mentioned accidental deaths related to children, arguments. Are there other themes or just stories you keep seeing again and again?
Well, there certainly is a lot of gang violence. Drive-by shootings is definitely something. And you know, I'm surprised. And there's a lot of murder suicides. I've been surprised by that too, where you know somebody shoots his children and wife, and then shoots himself. There's just a lot of that as well. Those are the ones that really stick in my mind.
Doing this every day, printing this, do you get depressed?
Yes, I do. My assistant gets really depressed because she's the one who's looking them up every day, and she'll often send me a note saying, it's a particularly grim one, you know, and she'll have the first five or six will be, you know, children. It really does get to you. It's very depressing. I don't know what else to say. It's very depressing.
Are you intending this at least in part as a political statement?
I don't know what that means exactly. I'm a journalist.
Well, I guess are you doing this hoping that some kind of political response comes from it in terms of guns and how we deal with them?
Yes, I most certainly am. You know, I'm an opinion columnist, and I have an opinion, which is that there are too many guns in the United States, and we would be better served with fewer and with fewer people having guns. I know that the political climate mitigates against that, but even now, there's a senator from Connecticut, Chris Murphy, who reads from the gun report. I don't know if he still does this, but he used to read from the gun report every Monday afternoon and pick a few of those names and tell the stories behind them. So, I mean, I think it has had some political reaction.
That's Joe Nocera. He stays with us after the news. He's an op-ed columnist at the New York Times. He compiles what we're talking about, the Gun Report, a daily tracking of media reports of gun-related violence here in the United States.
We continue our conversation now with Joe Nocera, op-ed columnist for the New York Times. We're talking about his daily gun report, an effort to track incidents of gun violence in the United States.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how his daily tracking of media reports of gun-related violence? Have you read the Gunn Report? What did you think? What did you feel when you looked at that? 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Shane on the line in Chicago. Shane, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up?
I just was wondering if the report includes the opposite of violence that was stopped or curtailed, or incidences where someone perhaps protected themselves and others or saved their own lives.
Gotcha.
Because they had a legal gun and they did know how to use it.
Shane, thanks for the call. You briefly touched on that earlier, Joe, but do you want to delve into that a little more?
I get asked that question a lot, and I get accused of not including such anecdotes. But in fact, when a gun is used to prevent a crime or a break-in or something, and a gun is shot, we do use it. If there's no shot and it doesn't make the newspapers, you know, we don't. We don't put it in. So, you know, are we undercounting that? I've been accused of that, but I don't really think we are.
Do you think the media undercounts that? I mean, that's an accusation from gun rights advocates that the media is more reluctant, doesn't see it as a story if there's a, I guess, in a shorthand, a positive use of a firearm.
Yes, I know that, but I know the media gets accused of that, but the statistics are pretty clear that having a gun in your house is far more likely to cause harm to someone in your family than it is to a burglar.
Shane, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Joy in West Bend. Joy, hi.
Hi. I want to thank your guest for undertaking this project, and you really did kind of answer my question. I was wondering how many people have a gun for their own protection in their home or on their person that actually get hurt by that. I remember the statistics for that used to be brought out in arguments for gun control, but I haven't heard that lately.
I don't know what the I don't remember what the statistical figure is.
Right, and you're not tracking statistics in the gun report, but how common is that as a theme over the last year of printing these?
You mean people being hurt because there's a gun in the house?
Mm-hmm.
It's extremely common. The ones that stick in my mind the most are the people, you know, the kids who get hurt or killed. Because they find a gun under the bed, or there's a loaded gun in the house somewhere. So those are the most memorable. But there's a whole category of gun violence that I call it's a momentary flash of anger. And if there wasn't a gun in the house, it might have turned into a fist fight, you know, or maybe less. But because there's a gun in the house, that somebody grabs the gun and shoots somebody else. And I find that to be quite a common theme in the gun report.
Short of a change in laws or gun control, do you think reading stories like this, talking about this, could lead to a change in our culture where we try to keep that gun at a remove to get past that flash of anger?
Well, I do. One of the things I've come away from one of the things I've come away from in doing the gun report is a belief that you could change a lot without any legislative change if you could change the culture. If people felt a need to keep their gun under lock and key, if people just took, you know, better care of their guns. I mean, I know a lot of people do, but a lot of people don't, and that's what one of the things I've learned. And I think that if you could change that culture, you could reduce gun deaths by 50%.
Thanks for the call, Joy. We'll go to Kathy now over in Door County. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to thank you so much for that report. I read the Times every day. I've been following it. I think every day when I read it, sometimes I've moved to tears almost. And it used to be that Jim Lehrer used to have something on at the end of his show where he showed the people that were killed in the war. And wouldn't it be wonderful at the end of every major news broadcasts, they would just read this report. And I think that might do something to change the culture in this country, because if people actually heard that and listened to it, maybe it would change the opinions of people, that everyone has to have a gun in their home. And I thank you again so much.
Kathy, thanks for the call. Joe, do you get a lot of responses like that?
I do. I get a fair number of emails and responses that basically say thank you for doing this. I also at some point when after Newtown, when people were, you know, when the furor had died down a little and we were still hanging in there with the gun report, I got an email from somebody that said you couldn't stop this now even if you wanted to. Kind of the way I feel about it. It's like we own it.
It's interesting that it strikes people as so powerful. I mean, the language is not dramatic. It's prosaic. It reads like a police report or a newspaper, you know, the police blotter out of a newspaper. Just is there something about, I don't know, the number of them, or just the sense of bearing witness to all these things? What is it that you think is powerful about this?
I think it's a little bit of both of those things. I do think the sheer number is sobering. But I also think that as you envision the incidents themselves, you know, so-and-so shot a 12-year-old in the face, and it causes you to recoil. And, you know, it's kind of in your face in the sense that, you know, when you read the gun report, you can't ignore the level of gun violence that goes on, and it's hard not to be struck at how needless so much of it is. And I think all of those together caused the report to have a very sobering effect on people.
An email from John. He writes, whether one is for or against handguns in this country, he says, an indisputable fact. There's more violence by handguns in the U.S. than any other country in the world, and more handguns in private hands in the U.S. than any country in the world. Do you think John has that right?
I do. I think it's pretty clear.
So our news team has just recently started an effort to track specifically gun homicides here in Wisconsin. Are you seeing more and more efforts to try to put not just numbers, but maybe the stories behind the numbers in places around the country?
Well, no, I applaud your effort, and it's the first such effort that I've actually heard of. You know, what generally happens is that after there is a new town, people are up in arms and extremely upset and agitated, and then over time we become inured to it, and it tends to fade away, and efforts like the gun report tend to end until the next one. And so, you know, from my point of view, I haven't seen a lot of efforts to do what you guys are trying to do, and I wish you all the luck on it.
Our listeners can follow that at WPR.org. Joe, before I let you go, no plans to end the gun report anytime soon?
No, sir. Right. We're in for the long haul.
Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
That was Joe Nocera. He's op-ed columnist for the New York Times, where he maintains the gun report. It's time for Wisconsin Life. This time of year, carpets of watercress cover many Wisconsin streams and springs. The tender green leaves are a bright and nutritious taste of the season if you know how and where to find it. Danny Lind takes us watercress hunting in the Driftless area.
Watercress isn't native to the U.S., but it's so naturalized that it just about might as well be. When people would come west, they would bring a little bit with them and plant it, and it pretty much just took over after that. It grows all year round. It's a perennial, and in really protected spots, you can harvest it all winter if it's a spring that stays open. Summertime is generally not the best time. It doesn't like the heat, so unless you're in a really protected spot where it's shady, it'll get kind of yellow, and it'll bolt, have little flowers on it, and it'll get super spicy and kind of bitter. But generally, the March and April are the best months. You never want to pull it out unless you're trying to thin out the patch a lot. But if you're someplace where you're wildcrafting it, it's definitely the considerate and responsible thing to do, to leave the roots in the ground so they can just grow right back. So we're just cutting it off right at the water surface. And you can see all those roots in there. You know, there's a lot of watercress that's cultivated, not as much in this country, although it's starting to take off more in this country, but in Europe. and England, they do a lot of cultivated watercress. They're so crazy about it. And it's, you know, a lot more heavily populated, so there's not as many wild places where it still grows. So this is a pretty calm little spring. There's lots of other places you can get it where it has the nice little tinkling sound. And this is, you can tell, a great place to get it pretty early in the season, like now, because it's so sunny. So there's all sorts of edible things right where we're at right here. We've got watercress, we've got some burdock right there, which we could dig up and eat the roots if we so desired. It's really good springtime thing to eat. It's very detoxing, good blood cleanser. It's kind of bitter, but you can cut it up and soak it in cold water and change the water a few times, and it really draws the bitterness out. You know, this time of year, I really like just having a little pile of watercress on the side of my plate, just about no matter what I'm eating. But it's really good in salads. It's really great in sandwiches. You can make pesto out of it. It's really awesome put in an omelet, just like right when you're almost done cooking the omelet, just set in there and fold it over, and it just barely wilts. That's really good. You can make watercress soup just with onions and potatoes and a little bit of milk or cream. I've been at potlucks in this neighborhood before where you're like, oh, there's nothing green. And somebody will say, oh, hold on, I'll go get some watercress. And they'll run down to their favorite watercress patch and come back with a bowl of watercress. Fairies love watercress. I think. I mean, who wouldn't?
Commentator Danny Lynn is the co-owner of Rooted Spoon Culinary and grows her own vegetables, fruits, and herbs on her Driftless area farm.
I'm probably not going to go slogging through the streams to gather watercress, but I am getting pretty excited about the concept of fresh local vegetables to cook with and eat.
I know. What are we going to do when it's not just potatoes and
carrots?
Potatoes.
Yeah. All right, well, something to look forward to. Oh, Wisconsin Life, by the way, is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Get more info at wisconsinlife.org.
Monique Hooker joins us now to talk about some of the other spring edibles that are coming into season in Wisconsin. She's a chef and cooking teacher, and she's also the author of Cooking with the Seasons, A Year in My Kitchen, and the founder of Got to Have Pie. Monique, welcome to Central Time.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, so we just heard about watercress. What are some of the other edible plants that we can begin to forage for here in Wisconsin?
Well, the watercress is the key that opens the flood of greens of spring. Let's put it that way. So he's the first one. The next one we're looking at is ramps, the wild leeks, and there's going to be festivals everywhere throughout the Driftless about this celebration of this wild leek-like onion that grows within in a forest floor. And you can make pesto with it, you can fry it, you can saute it, you can grill it, just like it looks like a somewhat of a green onion-like, and it has a leaf of a muguet lily. Let's put it that way. So it's very easy to identify. But let's put it this way. I think, you know, when we think of wild edibles and spring edibles, remember, eat them while they're young. This is when the best time. Don't start eating them when they are mature. They become pretty nasty. And
so is it that they're more tender when you get them when they're
tender,
young?
Exactly.
That sounds lovely.
They are young. Young spring greens, you know.
So you're talking about ramps and... If you want to harvest them on your own, do you have any suggestions about what sort of environment they like and how to harvest them so that they stay fresh?
The best way to find them, they are in a forest. They are in a forest and very heavily maple.
Okay, so look for a
maple
forest. If you have
a maple grove, you will find them. At one time, they were eradicated in some pasture because the cows would feed on them, and of course, the milk would have enough flavor. So, but they are coming back and really very protected in the forest. Actually, here when you come to the Driftless, your whole floor of the forest is green with them.
Really?
What you have to do is remember not to pull any of your wild edible. You have to cut them just at the root a little bit. So you leave something behind for next year.
Ah, I see. So you have to leave it for the next generation.
Now, respect to the land, you know, so you cannot eradicate them all. If we all did that, we'll have nothing left.
What is your favorite way to eat ramps?
My favorite way is to saute them in a little bit of olive oil. So you take the most of the greens off, and they look like very elongated little shallots. And I cook them very slowly, and the last 2 minutes or so, I just add a little bit of balsamic vinegar to kind of finish caramelizing them. Oh, they are so delicious.
Sounds pretty good. I bet they'd be good over pasta, too.
Yeah, exactly. With pasta, they are wonderful. And they make a great pesto.
Now, in terms of health information, is there anything we need to know as we harvest on our own, if we do that, about how to keep it safe and make sure that we're doing it the right way?
Well, first of all, I think you have to get yourself a very good book that helps you identify your greens. And one of the best ones is Peterson Field Guide or Peterson Field Guide. I think is the best one because there's pictures with everything. Second one is just work with someone who already knows. Trial and error is not something I suggest at all. Stay away from public roads because wild edibles are very absorbent of pollutants. So if you're close to a road or park or field, go in the wild, you know, trekking or in the, when you are walking, hiking, find a forest and things like that. It's wonderful. I would never do with that foraging. I am foraging like crazy right now. I can't wait.
And is it okay to do it on any land? I mean, presuming you're not trespassing, but how do you know where it's okay to actually harvest?
Well, I think, you know, public parks are the best, but public park, when I'm saying forest, I don't suggest, you know, a park in the city where all the dogs and everybody walks around. I mean, you know, you have a lot of chemicals. People do not use your lawn at all. I would definitely go out in the country and go out in the forest. Know your and it's always a guide. You know, if you go to your forest county bureau, they can tell you where to go and when you're hiking somewhere where to go. And if you know someone who has land, just ask them permission. Most of the time people are very kind about that, especially here in the Driftless. So those are the two things I would recommend to do.
Okay, so let's say we've got a lovely basket of watercress or some ramps. How should we clean it, and then how long will they last in your fridge?
Well, watercress, as the word says, lacks water, lacks to be cold. I would not suggest eating it after. Usually I stop by Memorial Weekend, I stop eating watercress. And it is tender, and it should be eaten tender. One of my favorite, which I just sent you a recipe on that today, is to watercress and ramp together. They seem to come up. One is water, one is land. And the ramp serves as an onion. The watercress is just cooked like spinach. But to clean them, always put a splash of vinegar in your water. Soak a lot of water. Do not use a big stems of watercress. You get plenty of watercress. You don't need to really chew through those mature stems. But the splash of vinegar in your water helps dislodge any little bugs that are in there. Don't forget it's spring. So your bugs are in there, you know, somewhere along the line you're going to have some. A lot of water removes a lot of the dirt, a lot of the woody compost or whatever comes with it. The ramps cut the roots off, and hopefully you didn't bring them home with you, because always go out in the woods with a little knife. That helps you cut and forage much easier.
So when you're talking about vinegar, just a splash of ordinary white kitchen vinegar?
Yes. Oh, I always recommend cider vinegar. I'm not
cider
a white vinegar person, no.
Okay. So walk us through this soup of yours. We've got the recipe up on the Central Time Facebook page. You said we've got the rams, which function as sort of a garlicky, oniony taste.
Right.
And we've got the watercress, which is that fresh green taste. How else do you make the soup? How does it come together?
Well, to thicken the soup, I like to use overcooked rice, a cup of overcooked rice. The rice has no flavor. It gives the soup a very nice velvety kind of texture. It's easy available because we all need it. We all eat in Chinese food. We all end up with too much rice to begin with. And you always cook rice. You always have a cup. So I always have cooked rice in my freezer. I like it better than to use flour. Flour is pasty. Cornstarch I don't recommend. So to thicken your soup, it's good. I would say potato, but potatoes are not in season. As far as I'm concerned, potatoes are not in season right now. so that rice wants to grow. So sauté your onions, you know, you cut them up like regular onions. You sauté them until they smell wonderful. Let your sense guide you. Your watercress is, after you've cleaned it and soaked it in lots of water and with a little splash of vinegar, you keep it in cold water, just like you would do with any leafy greens. Think of it as spinach. And then shake it up and add it to the hot pan so it steams itself. And you cook it until it's all wilted down. Add your rice to it. And then to that, you can add a vegetable broth or even a chicken broth if you want to. And to bind the whole thing, and just cook it for about 15, 20 minutes, maybe 25, depending on the many stems you have from the watercress, until it's all really soft. And puree the whole thing and make sure you season it with salt and pepper if you like. And I always like to add a little nutmeg to it.
Uh-huh.
Especially, and then you can finish your soup after you puree it. You finish your soup with a little bit of cream. Once the cream is in it, do not bring it back to a boil, because the cream and the watercress have a tendency sometimes to separate, because the watercress, if you do not kill enough of the acidity of the watercress, you might curdle your cream.
So the cream is your finishing touch, and I bet when it's done, it is the beautiful light green color of spring, isn't
it? Oh, it's gorgeous. Delicious.
It sounds lovely. Monique, thank you so much for sharing that recipe and for coming on to talk about greens with us today.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Monique Hooker, chef and cooking teacher. She's the founder of Cooking With, the author of Cooking With the Seasons, and the founder of Got to Have Pie.
And we've got that recipe for watercress soup up on the Central Time Facebook page. Even if I don't make that soup, I'm going to use that tip on using overcooked rice to thicken instead of flour. That's a great idea. Never would have thought of that.